Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
We've got Carol Carter back with us, and I'm super stoked. Every time she's gone, I miss her again. So Tom, Alan, and Carol, and we're all going to check in before getting ahead to the next Grapevine article. How's it going, Carol?
Great, actually. I'm still letting a lecture I heard with Fred Luskin a couple of weeks ago percolate. It was really, really moving, and I seem to be filtering my life experiences through the new information I have now. So it's been a very powerful lesson in learning about forgiveness and hearing a new layer of how I was carrying around grievances versus grief.
Can you tell can you tell us a little bit about what that was?
Sure. I think either he or Herb said, if you're carrying around a lot of, I guess it was Fred, Dr. Luskin, if you're carrying around a lot of anger 6 months after something happened, you could be setting yourself up for a poor outcome psychologically. Mm-hmm. Man, I got stuff I've been carrying around for 70 years, and I'm 73. Tom and I did a workshop during the fall where we were doing some sentence completions. And I heard one of my answers, and it was really ambiguous. I wasn't sure what I meant, but I learned after this time with Luskin what I meant by it. I was reluctant to let go of my grievances. That's why I was still stuck. I preferred to hold the grievance than to heal from it, because somehow I felt like I was dishonoring my experience if I was willing to heal from it.
Right.
Which is convoluted, but it's the truth. I wore the
banner. Well, that's a great question to ask, though, because, you know, what's the upside of me holding on to this is I had a client this week that was with a deal that she was having a really hard time letting go of. It didn't occur to me. I didn't ask the question, but she came up with it. She said, you know, I think I'm really having a hard time letting go. It was, you know, something that is just, you know, you would think, of course you want to let go of it. But she was, you know, she worked her way to the place where she had a very clear idea of what she was avoiding by not doing it.
Yes.
And it was beautiful. So that sounds like a similar thing. That's great.
Yeah. And what's cool about it is you don't have to say, you know, anybody's off the hook. I've had a lot of, victimizing circumstances. Some things were pretty horrible a few times. That doesn't mean they weren't awful. It just means I have processed the feelings around them, and I'm willing to move on with my life and not let information, let unexpressed feelings or not having fully reconciled that this happened, that is the reality, and I need to not argue with life that it happened because it already did.
Right.
So I can free myself to be more fully present in my moments. And it's hard to be present when you are defended against what happened, trying to change what happened. You're angry about what happened. You're not present for your life. And one of the reasons I retired last year was to really put 2 feet into my life and start living it and get rid of distractions. And so my resentments, my grievances had not matured yet from grief to letting go. It just went from grief to grievance, and I've been carrying them, and I'm really enjoying letting so much go. Every time a new grievance pops up, I'll look at it again with new eyes, and I'm able to let it go. So it's been a really healing experience the last 2 weeks. Really powerful, and I'm very grateful. And Fred Luskin has a way. And also, if anybody listening wants to hear his lectures, they're available on YouTube. The same message he did in the workshop with Herb is right there on YouTube. He's very quiet and gentle and powerful and simple. And some of the strongest truths to me are the simplest ones to get.
Well, listen, he captured such an important part of the first the grievance process and then the forgiveness process.
Yes.
If we go through it real quick, because I'm familiar with his work a lot, because Herb when Herb met him in a workshop, and it's amazing to me the overlap between his work and emotional sobriety.
Yes.
Well, one thing that out was that he really spends a lot of time saying the grievance occurs when we take what the other person did personally.
Yes.
See, so it's like they shouldn't have done this to me, or life shouldn't have done this to me, and that we have big should that we're holding on to. And so we feel that that unenforceable rule, as he likes to call it, Virginia Satir called it the rules, but it's the same idea, got violated. And then he said what was brilliant about his work, I thought, was how once then we have that experience, we come up with a narrative that makes it. And this is where you'd like, Tom, where also the overlay with emotional sobriety is you can't have emotional sobriety and be a victim. Just impossible to have that victim mentality. So what he says is we come up with that narrative. The problem becomes is that we have these, we re-traumatize ourselves every time we tell the story. So it's almost like me ripping the scab off of a wound every time I have the wound and not letting it heal. And he says that every time we retell that story with us being a victim, we re-traumatize ourselves. And that re-traumatization keeps that taking it personal very alive. Mm-hmm. And so we get caught in this narrative that creates this prison of unforgiveness and resentment and bitterness and all that other stuff that comes with a lack of forgiveness. And he says, and guess what? And all the time, the person that we're resenting or the situation is getting free. It's brilliant. His work is brilliant. I agree, Carol.
Yeah. I even had a new thought this morning. You mentioned experimental psychology in the last Thursday night meeting. That was one of my favorite subjects in the 80s. And I had written a correlational proposal for a correlational study. I had been dating someone with MS. I was the local chair of the MS Society, and I noticed that everyone in my immediate circle there, except one person, had shared with me a profound, horrific trauma in childhood. And my thought was, wouldn't it be interesting if they blamed themselves? They turned on themselves, and that's where autoimmune came from. So I was wanting to research whether or not that was a possibility. But what I now think this morning is, it's not so much did they have trauma, were they stuck in grievance versus grief and never had processed their grief and then turned the grievance internally. And the basis for that idea was I had found a study that showed one person, I don't know what it's called now, but at that time it was called multiple personality disorder. I think it's changed now in the DSM-5, but I don't know what it is now. But somebody was found to have different relationships with type 1 diabetes in different alters. One was dependent on medication in one alter and not in another on type 1. And so that told me there's something really powerful about what's going on in the brain to influence whether or not you're having, anyway. But I think there's something to that about where they are in the process. And I don't want to make assumptions or suggest anyone with a certain illness brought it on themselves. I really don't. That was a 30-something-year-old doing some thinking out of some observations in life. And who knows how that all starts. But it was an interesting thought.
You seem remarkably present, Carol. Like, I don't know, I have a hard time envisioning a version of you that's, try to jump outside of the moment, I guess. But I didn't know you before, so there you have it.
Well, I'm certainly with my peeps here today, so of course I'm going to be present.
I wanted to, before asking Tom something, I wanted to catalog a very petty resentment I've been having, which is that I'm here with my girlfriend's dog, who's Brady, who's really lovely, and he, the length that he will need to walk to go to the bathroom is like the length the fellowship walked in Lord of the Rings. You know, it's just, I feel like I'm walking for hours with this guy and he's just looking for that perfect patch of ground to go to the bathroom. And I was personalizing it. I'm just like, why are you doing this to me? Like, I've already got my steps in for the day, you know, like why? It's just bowels. It's just a colon. It's not about me. I need to remind myself of that. But I was going to say, Tom, you made a social media update. We share a Instagram account. At one point, I was advertising podcast stuff on it, and not so much anymore. But you had made a post about some writing that you were getting into. And so the way it is set up on my phone is that, like, my phone will beep whenever somebody likes a post that you do or comments on it or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was just getting this torrent of, like, people, you know, just popping up and, you know, attaboying you and stoked about whatever the new piece of writing is. And I've been, you know, I've talked with you guys and on the pod before about, like, the struggles of my writing and kind of, like, the fear I have of, you know, getting started, or like my perfectionism kind of like sabotaging me and whatnot. And I just thought I'd ask, since it looks like you're getting into some projects now, whether you're continuing projects that you had before your illness or starting up new ones. I just wanted to see how that was all going, and, you know, if there's any emotions.
Well, it's good. It's you know, one of the dangers of putting a post out there like that is you get a lot of positive feedback from people, and then a guy in your head goes like, okay, well, you don't really have to do it right now. It's like you're feeling good about yourself. I'll be getting to that really soon. It's like, I'm actually working on what is turning out to be one of my favorite projects, which is right now it's an ebook. I'm looking at I'm revising and expanding, because it's really my favorite thing I've ever written in my life ever. And I'm getting some feedback from people to see if they think it's worth pursuing it. And it's a book I wrote accidentally. I do book covers. I do stupid book covers for April Fool's jokes. Like one last time, I think it was like, it was a book about how to make everything everybody else's fault. You know, and I swear to you, no matter what I put out there as a book cover, somebody contacts me and wants to know where they can get the book.
I was going to ask you where I can get it.
I'm going to go. I promise you, the people who want this book don't need the book. It's like, because they already know how to do that. This one was some of you guys have read some pieces of this. It's called Sit Down and Shut Up, and I just thought that was a funny title for a meditation book. So I put that out there years ago, and over a long period of time, people would write to me and ask me where they get the book, and there's no book. It was just a joke. And then I'll tell the short version of this. Then Donald Trump became president, and everybody's anxiety went through the roof, and I began to hear from so many people with so much anxiety, so I thought, well, I'm just going to write a few pieces to go with this book cover, because I think I could make something that could be useful to people. And I did that, and I just kept writing it, and now I've decided I'm back to it. I want to see what I can pull off. It's one of those, you know, just having had cancer, just having been sick for really the first time in my life, you know, it's like it just puts you more in touch with your mortality. And I'm just starting to go, what do I want to be sure I do before I, you know, what do I want to finish before I drop off the face of the earth? And this is one of them. So thanks. I will keep working on it and try really hard not to just take the pats on the back from everybody. And that creates dopamine in your brain, and you feel good. And so you can stop, but I'll keep going.
Yeah, we have a grapevine article to get ahead to, but I just wanted to put a button on that by saying it's tough to be a writer and to kind of like hover in that space between, you know, over self-satisfaction and punitive kind of like self-hate and self-sabotage. You know what I mean?
Right.
Short circuit the whole thing. It's
right.
I don't know. Some people have this miraculous ease with it. That's never been me. But, you know, I'm glad.
No, I think most of us as writers are, you know, I've gotten lots better. I'm a lot better. But we have a long history. Most of us have histories of being absolutely horrible to ourselves. You know, not in a productive way, but we just tend to be, most of the writers I know, you don't know what it means to just be complete, you know, condemning assholes to themselves.
Alan taught me a gestalt exercise. I'm going to start trying with mine. So I'll let you guys know off the record how that's all going. But
share the exercise later too.
Oh yeah, I will. I'll give you the, you know, the dumbed down version. Our article for this week is called Getting the Help. It's from the January 2024 Grapevine issue. focusing on emotional sobriety. And we're going to do a round table. We're going to go around and read paragraphs from the story. Do you want to get us started, Alan?
Well, I also want to know how Alan's doing. We haven't really checked in with Alan.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah, please.
You do that on a regular basis, Patrick. You skip Alan frequently.
It was our soft start.
That's because he's updated with me frequently. We talk a lot outside. He knows what's going on. I think that,
he knows. I know what's going on with Alan. I don't want to hear it.
I don't want to hear it. I'm tired of his complaining. I'm tired of my complaining, to tell you the truth.
Listen, you have reason to complain.
I think right. Swelling in my leg is going down. That's really good news.
Good.
Below my knee, it's probably 80% decreased. Above my knee, it's probably 50% less. So it's definitely moving in the right way. The pain has been pretty significant since the break. It's been challenging to manage at times. I've been staying in bed a lot more and doing sessions from my bed, which is okay. There's been a few times when it's, you know, I'm usually very much engaged, but because the pain is so great, I'll close my eyes at times and almost fall asleep. I mean, because that's just my response to pain at times is what happens. So from that end, I'm doing really better. I'm excited. I'm looking forward to seeing what the doctor is going to say on Tuesday morning. I had driving privileges back for 2 days and then lost them. So I don't think I'm ready to drive again. I can tell that. Mm-hmm. So I don't like being so confined and dependent on everyone else. That's the emotionally biggest challenge I'm having right now. That part. And also, you know, learning something from what happened with this injury. You know, I have some culpability in the fact of pushing myself too hard in PT, and that there's something to learn from this. I'm just not a victim of what they've missed. I think they did miss something. It's a perfect storm. So overall, I think I'm moving in a good direction. I'm excited about hearing what the doctor is going to say and see what the next step is on Tuesday. My hunch is they're going to probably do some more film, probably x-rays, maybe an MRI, to get a clear picture of what's happening around there. So that's where I am. Looking forward to
being
with
you. Can I ask you a question about it?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Are you finding also that there is a gift in the vulnerability of needing others? Have you felt that at all?
I've felt that there's a gift and there's also a lesson. Is my ex has a limited ability to be responsive to my needs right now for a lot of different reasons. So just to give an example, 2 weeks ago, when this thing went down, she asked her boss if she could work from home so that I would have somebody around. And he said, okay. So then Monday, I get up and she's going to work. And I go, well, I thought you were working. Oh, well, I have to go in today because I have this thing, I said, that's fine. In the future, it would be helpful to let me know because I need to get somebody to come over to help me. I can't.
Right.
I'm very limited in terms of what I can bring to get up to even get myself food. I couldn't stand on my leg for more than 5-10 minutes, Carol. Mm-hmm. So that's not much time to get something
done. I'm surprised you could do even that much.
So it's being coordinated like that, which, you know, we did well when we were married, and it's even worse now that we're in the process of a divorce. So that's hard, is being vulnerable on her because she's the one that's around because of the girls most of the time. My babysitter, Gail, is wonderful. And with her, sometimes it's hard to receive her generosity. She's so responsive to everything. I feel a little bad about oh my God, am I taking advantage? You know, but she's been wonderful. And I'm very grateful that she's around and helpful and stuff like that. So it's been a mixed bag for me around that whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I would really am missing in my recovery is having somebody in the household, because I don't want to put this on the girls, that could really lay with me and be concerned and show some nurturing and nourishment at times, right? Just put their arm around me and just say, let's just lay here together, or let's just fall asleep together, or something like that. You know, it's, I would love that at this point. And that's not available at this point in time for me. And it's sad. That part is sad for me, is realizing how much that I don't have that in my life at this point with someone that I'm close to in that way, a significant other, whatever you want to call them.
Did you get your new puppy?
Oh, they're wonderful. We got
Are you able to cuddle your puppy until you can have that need met?
That puppy has been a source of a lot of petting and therapy. There's no question. And listen, and you know, the girls are wonderful. My daughters have been great, but I don't want to put all of that on them. But Cece has slept with me a few times to in
That's
bed with
great.
Me. Oh, that she said, Dad, can I sleep with you tonight? I welcome it. So that's been nice to have that. You know, but it's that line of, I don't want to turn to her to take care of me, you know. It's,
right.
I want to hold that parent job to her, but I do let her be responsive. And my other daughter comes in and gives me these wonderful hugs. And so it's not a black and white situation at all.
Right.
So moving forward, you know, we'll see what that means. Like I said, Tuesday is going to help me get some sense of what the next step is in recovery here. And so I'll make some decisions at that point.
Well, thank you for sharing.
Well, let's dig into this article. As Patrick said, I'll go ahead and kick us off. In 1970, the doctors were treating me with an antipsychotic medication. A normal dose was 400 milligrams. They had me on 1,600 milligrams. So, or four times the normal dose. But it still wasn't enough. They gave me a short haul pass to leave the locked psychiatric ward to walk the hospital grounds. So another patient and I cooked up a scheme to get some wine. He knew where the liquor store was. We got some Ripple wine, and I got snot flying drunk. We somehow staggered back to the entrance to the large ward building at the hospital in San Francisco, which was a major Army hospital during the Vietnam War. It was my third hospitalization in 1 year.
I was a mess. The first night I got there, I had an out-of-body experience, which perhaps was part of the grounds for all that medication. They kept me for 90 days observation, then gave me a medical honorable discharge from the Army, a giant disgrace and a low point in my list of failures. I was a 22-year-old unemployable mess. I moved in with Mom and Dad. In 1973, by the grace of God, I wound up twice more in another psychiatric ward, where I found AA. After several weeks there, I got to the meeting where I asked for a sponsor. Sponsorship was the topic that day, so I asked and received.
I have clinical depression and other mental disorders, yes, but AA and a sponsor allowed me to stay sober and live a good and successful life. I got sober, began working the steps, got active as a secretary, started going to college, and fixed a severe reading comprehension problem in the school's learning lab. I grew from a failing student to almost a straight-A student. Then I earned a bachelor's degree in journalism. In 1980, God gave me a dream job at a Fortune 500 company where I worked as a writer in public relations with the U.S. Space Shuttle program for 26 years, retiring with a pension. I had much success at that job, but trouble was coming.
In the early 1990s, I was staying sober, doing service in AA at hospitals and institutions, talking with my sponsor and helping other drunks work their AA program. However, I still had grave emotional disorders, plus a very severe anger problem. I was on the phone to my sponsor regularly, sometimes quite regularly. He always helped me tremendously to minimize damage in situations that I seemed to get myself into. Eventually, at 22 years sober, my wife left me and took the kids. I then lost the house we were buying along with my life savings. I was so ashamed. I joined a little church where they lavished prayer on me, prayer that I could survive all this loss, and prayer to perhaps change enough to get my family back. My employer decided I needed to go to anger management meetings. There, I learned how to understand my anger and the reasons behind it. All the while, I was going to AA at a meeting full of loving old timers, and they helped me a lot.
2 years later, I met my wonderful wife-to-be. We have been happily married now for over 20 years, and the anger problem seems to be behind me. Some of the best things I do now are to stay active, go to meetings, go to AA meetings, and sponsor people. I go to the nearby Apache Reservation in the White Mountains of Arizona. There, I try to share hope, love, and light on alcoholic situations that are very, very difficult to break. The members there have little work or housing, no educational facilities, and the party is still raging where they live. I see them when they get out of treatment. I tell them I didn't want to be an alcoholic, but I am one. And I am so glad I found out and got to AA. I tell them I found an answer that works when life is good and when life is difficult. Like when both of my parents killed themselves. I offer my help if they want it and promise that if I don't know the answers to their questions, I will ask my sponsor.
In 1973, I arrived at AA as a 25-year-old with 5 trips to the psych ward. I'm now 71. I've had continuous sobriety for 46 years, despite anger and grave emotional and mental disorders. God has been good to me. I appear to have survived my move from California to Arizona 17 months ago, but I don't take my sobriety for granted. As I am powerless, I must continue to do the things that work. I don't have it made. I get a daily opportunity to live a spiritual life and pass it on. Regardless of my serious challenges, I found hope in AA.
I say this every time, but now that's my favorite one. I tell you, one of the things I love about it is it's different from some of, to me anyway, maybe it's the way I was hearing it, but it's different from some of the stories we hear, which is, you know, some stories fit back into that whole idea of what would say how to share in AA was how it was, what happened, and how it is now. This is a story that is so realistic. I mean, was for a guy who, I mean, all the guy you get to the, he kind of tosses in toward the end that both his parents committed suicide. Jesus, it was never easy. It's never been easy for him. And yet he's been in solid recovery the whole time. He's, you know, and the emotional sobriety is obviously the stuff that he continued to struggle with, which is a lot more of the gray area. You know, we always tell people that, you know, stopping drinking or stopping using drugs is like lifting the hood of the car so you can get to the engine, because that's where the work, we have to do the work. And it seemed like it was, you know, if it wasn't one thing, it was another that he was still having to deal with. But when he stopped drinking, he had to deal with a lot of stuff and over a lot of years, and he has been doing it and he's still doing it. It's just, that's just real.
When he got some physical sobriety, you know, he thought he was out of the woods, but, you know, it's like Alan always talks about, then the real work begins once you attain some physical sobriety.
Yep.
And oftentimes that doesn't entail just going to meetings.
What stood out to you, Carol?
Well, I was just thinking, I heard a parallel. You know, we've all had so many things happen in our lives. And I have had one sort of foot out of observing my life. And I think of things I've lost as information. Like I was no longer somebody's wife, so I had to learn a new way of being. I was no longer, then when my daughter turned 13, the primary caregiver because she wanted to move in with her dad and experience life with her dad. And so I had to let that go. And, you know, just various things through life. And I noticed he had so many losses, and he didn't get lost in the losses. He kept coming back. He kept doing the work. He showed up. He didn't, whether he took it personally or not, he took it apparently well enough to hold on to himself. He knew where home was. He knew where he would be safest. And he kept coming to meetings, and he stayed in his community. And, you know, to me, it doesn't get better than that. It's wonderful. He could have taken every single one of those things incredibly personally and just gone off the deep end and been lost, and he didn't let his losses lose him.
I love what you said about he knew where home was. You know, home is where we're the safest. Home is where we can be our true selves, take our armor off. Home is always, in my opinion, in relationship. And and he talks about the old, going to the meeting toward the end. He talks about the meetings with the old timers and this, you know, just surrounding him with love. Even, you know, and he wasn't saying that's when he was doing the great. He was, no matter what was going on with him, he continued to put himself back in those, he brought himself back home.
Yes.
I'm taking that one with me. That's a beautiful piece.
And his start was so chaotic and looked like a point of no return, four times the max dose of medication, and still, you know, acting out, wanting to put wine on top of that. It just shows, and we've all had our craziest moments in some capacity, in whatever our thing was that we were doing. He knew how to get lost, but he really did. He also learned how to get found. And
from a professional point of view, you know, and this is a judgment, I'm going to own that, but it's, you know, what do we know when somebody tells a story in which he was on four times the usual prescribed medication? It meant the professionals had no idea what to do with him. I mean,
yes.
And professionals have a really hard time. They still do today. We I should put myself in the category. We do too. Admitting when we don't know something, and it's so important for people who are treating professionals to be able to say, I don't know, I can't figure this out. We need some help. Need to get some more information in. But you're right. A lot of people, and I worked in institutions early in my career. Worked at state hospitals. You know, people. People in those situations can end up getting lost forever. It's beautiful. I'm very grateful that he made his way out.
I think we can all relate on some level to when he says, I didn't want to be an alcoholic, but I am one. And so I'm so glad I found out and got to AA. You know, and the way I relate to it is that I have these aspirations of being a big deal and doing different things. If at the end of the day, I can just kind of belong to a fellowship and I can heal myself by healing others and just kind of be in the space that saved my life, this work, it gets you to like and respect the right things. It can anyway. Yeah. Ego still fucks with it, but yeah.
Oh, that's true,
also,
man.
Patrick, I want you to know you're a big deal.
I was just about to say that. I think it's redefining, you know, Tom really looks at definitions. Define big deal. And to me, man, you're a big deal in my life.
Mm-hmm. Thank
you. Well, let me tell you some of the things that stood out for me about this. If we start to stand back and really try to abstract some of the ideas that he's applying to his recovery that have really made a difference in terms of the experience he's having today. So the first thing that we've got to all understand is that some diagnoses are not useful. Got to be really careful. There's a difference between a diagnosis that helps us find a path and a diagnosis that puts us in a box and creates a hopelessness.
Labels us,
Yes, labels us, man. When you're labeled a psychotic and you're schizophrenic and stuff like that. And I'm not saying that that's not the truth for some people, but to do that with a person that's suffering from alcoholism and not to be able to sort out the contribution that the alcohol and other drugs may be contributing to that person's psychosis can be a serious mistake, diagnostic mistake. I've seen people that were, this one guy I remember that we treated at the hospital, he had an axe and he was outside of his house looking for the guy that was having an affair with his wife so he could chop him into pieces. And his wife wasn't having an affair. He was in a paranoid delusion that was created by his excessive drinking. He developed what was called alcoholic jealousy. And he was totally out of his friggin' mind. And 6 years later, he became the CEO of our treatment center. I mean, that's how... I mean, well, you might have to be psychotic to want that job, but that's another issue and another day at time. My point is that a diagnosis like that has to be held very loosely in your hands. Now, when we say something like alcoholism, well, that points to a solution. And that can give us a path and can be really helpful in terms of it. So that's the first thought, is that he found a diagnosis that could lead him out of the trouble he was in, not keep him in trouble. Yes. So that's number one.
That's nice.
Is that he had, there was some part of him that he had some faith in his ability to grow and develop. And oftentimes that gets so lost in terms of our experience in life. You know, we keep doing the same thing, expecting different results, and there's no difference, right? In fact, things don't get better, they get worse. And so there's a part of us that gives up on ourselves, right? That we lose interest. And recovery is about, in my opinion, restoring our curiosity to ourselves and what's possible, right? Restoring those possibilities in our life. And we hear his story as being that. The third thing is that he used some of his upset and discord, let's say his anger issues, to address that problem and start to get on top of something that was important, that was interfering with his relationships and his life. So that's the other thing, is that in emotional sobriety, we don't avoid those character defaults, as we've come to call them, that are impacting our life in a negative way. We try to get our hands on them and do the best we can to start to cope with them, understand them, and to transform them into something that can help us grow and become the person that we want to be. And he did that with his anger issue, right? I think, and that's why he's been able to be married and have what we can assume is a pretty good marriage for the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. And finally, he embodied the thing that we talk about all the time. He started with an I'm okay if mentality. And through his recovery, he developed an I'm okay even if. I'm okay even if I get divorced. I'm okay even if I have this problem. I'm okay even if I have that. See, and that is the critical thing. Emotional sobriety is a consciousness of emotional freedom. And boy, doesn't his article totally portray that for each and every. It gives us a lot of hope, right? And that was the title of this, wasn't it? You know, what were the title that we started, Getting the Help, which means, you know, there's a lot of hope in it. And finally, the last thing that we've been beating a drum on, Tom, is acceptance. Mm-hmm. You know, none of this happens without accepting who you are and what's going on. And yeah. That was acceptance just kind of, you know, totally integrated in everything that he was talking about in terms of what he was doing. So this is a great illustration of the power of emotional sobriety.
Can I add in a spiritual thing that I heard too in the article? I had gotten an inkling about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, that my only job here is that I was the perfect Carol that was created when I was created. I'm exactly who life had in mind when I was created. My only job is to remove the obstacles from me being me, mm-hmm. to make my contribution to life. He removed his obstacles,
yeah,
so that he could have the life he wanted to have. And he did. He had a new relationship and has been happily married. To me, I think it's pretty cool. And I don't know that it's just formulaic. If I'm a good boy, all this stuff's going to happen like I want. But I think it's important for us to overcome our hurdles, to be free to be fully present in the lives that we have as a possibility. And
that's beautiful. But see, I'd change it just a little bit, Carol. You said he overcame his obstacles. He's overcoming his obstacles. That's his way of moving through life. Overcoming your obstacles.
Yes.
He's like, he's in our age range. He's 71. He's not done. He's right in the middle of it. You know, I always say, I want my fear of death to be the fear of interruption. Don't bother me. I'm busy. You know,
exactly.
And he's busy.
Yeah. I spoke
he's
of it as an event it. And it's not.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you, Tom. Yes. That's how he's living. He just keeps mm-hmm. on moving the stones out of the way and keeps on walking.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool.
It's freeing to think that way. Yeah.
Alan, I love how you just break it down into the tenets of emotional sobriety. That was beautiful.
We've been doing this for a while now, and these things really stand out now. You know, when I hear this stuff, it just jumps right out at me in terms of what's behind it all. And that's the beauty of really unpacking what emotional sobriety is. Right? We see some of the core principles of it. And look, they just keep showing up. It's that movement from I'm okay if to even if. I mean, it's a important transformation. The other movement is from environmental support to self-support. And we see that in this as well, as he's really supporting himself better in his recovery based on his relationship to his experiences instead of letting the experiences define him. So this is wonderful, man. And I'm so glad we've been doing this, and I'll look forward to next week, Patrick.
Until next week.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.